Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations available 24/7 to the world online. Today is December 20th, 2011. I'm in the offices of Paul Steelman, architect in Las Vegas. And this is part two of our interview that we're doing, talking about his career and the Strip. So I want to talk about some of your projects that you've designed. For example, the riverboats, you talked about some of the difficulties of those. How about building something, your work with the Stratosphere in Las Vegas? What was that like?
It wasn't great. Inexpensive project. We spent $44 million on the base. Tower was there, half-built when we started. Bob Stupak, unusual customer. Lyle Berman, not a Las Vegas guy. He's a very, very smart guy. Indian casino type of guy. Wrong design premise. I mean, when you tell me in a meeting that go up and look at the people with the Excalibur and we are going for a lower market than them, that's not setting your sights too high. Trying to build around a really super non-conforming building. I mean, it just was very difficult. To give you an idea, all the we built the tower wing, the first wing, then we built the second wing, and we went up and all when we got upstairs and they break through the walls, all the floors were misaligned, and none of the existing Stupak world was built per the drawings. And
wow.
Nobody shot the elevations to actually figure it all out. It was all fucked up. At the end of the day, I always thought it had a good premise. It had a big attraction. But greed was so big that by the time you walked and got your ticket, the event of the tower was so long that it killed the casino. So, greed, I mean, trying to satisfy the retailers so they would pass people through the shops that bought the magnets and things like this. I mean, it was a problem.
So going to the other end of the spectrum, how about the Desert Inn 1997 expansion?
That was like my Steel Pier project almost to me, because that was a historic building.
Yeah.
And Rand Arascog was a quality client. And we thought that that was a great, great project. They had many architects look at it when we showed Rand. In between the Knicks and the Bulls game, I might add, a playoff game, when we showed him our Palm Beach, our Palm Beach retheming of that, the Desert Inn, get it hooked into the golf course better, do the new clubhouse. I don't even remember the clubhouse. I don't remember what we did there. But, it was redefining a classic beauty, I thought. And I thought our little design slice, even Steve Wynn called me and told me what a great slice that we had built, that small little lobby, but it sliced out to the pool and it sliced out to the... It really showed the suburban experience out on the Strip. I mean, that was a good deal.
So I'd like you to follow up a little bit about the Strip as a suburban place. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. We've always felt in every building that we design that, the escapism that is required by most of the people that live in urban settings is required to, in fact, be put on the Strip. That's what makes a vacation a vacation. Going from one city urban fabric to another is a lot less desirable. Most people try to escape from their current environments. So, we've always looked at every one of our projects on the Strip or projects that contain casinos generally, because they are mini vacations, as suburban experiences with lots of landscaping and buildings that are the right scale, entrances that feel as if you are entering something very special, something very gives the impression that you will be outside even if you're not. And, when we did the Desert Inn, we wanted to put that all the way through the middle of the project so that the beautiful back area of the Desert Inn actually came right out to the Strip.
So on the strip, how important is a setback from the street?
I think it's real important. I think there has been some mistakes made in the past with zoning and planning and politics. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as success is realized, there are many, many changes that are considered. And sometimes the right political administration, in fact, did make a change or revision mm-hmm. to the zoning code that wasn't very prudent.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the great, you know, if the Strip was all the Imperial Palace and mm-hmm. none of the Bellagio, believe me, the Strip would not be successful.
Yeah. So how do you maintain this suburban feel when you have a lot of developments being increasingly urban in nature, and also when you have the Strip being more interconnected with the pedestrian pathways?
Well, one of the things we've always thought that has not been accomplished yet is our bridges are treated like highway overpasses.
Mm-hmm.
There are some absolutely gorgeous examples of bridges throughout the United States, especially, and Europe. I mean, the Venetian, Venice, Rome, Italy, Ponte Vecchio, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these bridges were works of art.
Mm-hmm.
They were commerce. They housed commerce. They didn't house, you know, guys selling bottles of water in a gum-laden concrete floor.
Yeah.
There is a very, very special bridge in Indianapolis. I believe it's called the Arts Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we show that to many people about these bridge connections. The bridge connections should really take on a more suburban experience, you know, being a more glass-enclosed, green, garden-like assembly
mm-hmm.
that people pass through as kind of a respite, kind of the neutral space between mm-hmm. building to building. What did Don Brinkerhoff and, you know, his great firm do is down the middle of the strip do a beautiful landscape buffer that technically you pass through going side to side mm-hmm. in a car. The same should be true up on our bridges. It isn't at this time.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, where does the money come from to actually do that? But someday it will.
Yeah.
Someday. It's a valuable piece of real estate, so.
Well, how else would you try to handle the pedestrian flow on the strip? You know, do you think that should be an important part of properties? With the Cosmopolitan, they made a big deal that that was right on the strip.
Yeah. Well, for years, there's been two philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I did the Mirage with Joel Bergman, we made a model and had some very sophisticated cameras before the invention of 3D architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually put a model, built a lake, and put that model in different spots and took actual, you know, pictures,
mm-hmm.
actual eye-level pictures mm-hmm. of the place to determine how far and how tall the Mirage should sit back from the
mm-hmm.
street. It, you might not know this, but the Mirage actually sits almost 30 feet above the level of the mm-hmm. Las Vegas Boulevard. Virtually no one actually really figures that out. There were spots at the Castaways. Caesars was fairly high, but at the Castaways it really fell away. And Steve was adamant about creating the proper scale and respect for the strip.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, buildings should sit proud when they sit back. I
mm-hmm.
mean, a castle is always on the top of a hill.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that type of architectural theory now pierces through, goes through to what we're trying to do. Very, very few hotel casinos that have been developed actually had that attitude.
Really?
I mean, Steve had the space, was giving away the space on the strip to
mm-hmm.
create his environment. And he then took the attitude to get the scale exactly right, which he did. That relationship of scale, architecture, space, suburbanization, you know, the scenery of the project,
mm-hmm.
You know, it can't be actually regulated.
Yeah.
Someone that would come in and say the Cosmopolitan, you know, in that philosophy,
mm-hmm.
you know, the old air door philosophy. Okay, I got slots, bing, 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 bing. I put up an air door. I make the air door as wide as possible. I spend $150,000 on it. So it would be nicer for a person to walk into my casino and,
mm-hmm.
and play a slot machine. You know, Steve always took the opposite approach to that you were actually creating a resort. That resort was an environment. And you weren't going to make that much money on that one single slot machine that was by that air door. Mm-hmm. I mean, the casinos, the old-time casinos that you would walk in and there'd be a craps table right there, I mean, that's kind of all over.
Mm-hmm.
Because it actually breaks one of the fundamental rules of gaming design.
Which is
we have to wow them in the lobby.
Okay.
I mean, the lobby creates the impact. It actually creates if your casino is going to be luxurious or a grind joint.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have no lobby, then you are a grind joint. And mm-hmm. if you're a grind joint, you're only going to make a certain amount of money forever. So the Venetian, Palazzo, Wynn, Mirage, of course, was the infant in this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't know how many gamblers told me that while we were building the Mirage, that whole glass atrium thing was a total waste of money.
Really?
Of course.
Huh.
Yeah. Prime time square footage. We need to put a slot machine there, not a beautiful statue of a mermaid. So there was a lot of people. The Bob Stupaks of the world, you know, the Jackie Gons of the world, those types of guys that would never go for anything like that.
That's pretty incredible. So I want to kind of transition to another project you did in the Strip, which was Treasure Island's 1998 renovation. Can you talk a little bit about how you work in that context, where you're working on something that's there and you're, you know, renovating a small part of it?
Well, the Treasure Island was always a great building. Joel
mm-hmm.
designed it,
mm-hmm.
and it was very successful, probably the most successful per square foot investment in Las Vegas at the time.
Hmm.
And still, although it still remains that way,
mm-hmm.
we knew that Steve Wynn, in doing that particular, Steve Wynn and Mark Shore, Mark
mm-hmm.
Shore was intimately involved in that renovation, that Mark, they really almost predicted the end of the kind of tacky themed
yeah.
casinos. They knew they had one.
Mm-hmm.
They knew it was wildly popular,
mm-hmm.
very successful. But yet Steve wanted to put some of Steve into it
mm-hmm.
and Steve's attitudes. And one of those things was to not have the registration lobby in a typical old Vegas form that was very, very close to the casino. Actually, the casino abutted it.
Mm-hmm.
Steve was at that opinion at that time. You know, Steve always had, from a design perspective, especially in this project, you know, commerce on the left, gaming on the right, you know, that type of thing. And when you do, in fact, have commerce on the left, you know, retail,
mm-hmm.
restaurants,
mm-hmm.
theaters, tandem-based activities, and gaming on the right, then
mm-hmm.
it works out to be very, very successful. What that, in fact, does is when we started that renovation,
mm-hmm.
We really wanted to put windows in it.
Okay.
And this was, we understood from the coffee shop at Treasure Island, and most coffee shops around town, the old coffee shop, the El Rancho, they wanted the Riviera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, face it. Anybody who was having breakfast in the morning, lunch in the afternoon, whatever, gravitated towards those windows.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve, of course, was bold enough to allow and promoted this idea, and we were able to build that entire registration lobby without the typical support space that most hotels require.
Mm-hmm.
Most hotels require, you know, the reservation, offices,
yeah.
all types of technical support spaces behind it that relate to this. But we were able to do that and able to renovate the pool, able to change the entrance sequences, able to build a beautiful Italian restaurant that had the art of Frank Sinatra in it,
mm-hmm.
able to build a new lounge bar that was built there. And it was a great project to work within the context of, yes, we have a theme, but no, it's not going to be ticky-tacky anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be kind of a historically scaled project, very well done, with no expense spared, I might
mm-hmm.
also add it. And it kind of is a forerunner to many of what many people like today. They do like a themed project or a project that is a little bit more rooted in history,
mm-hmm.
Rather than something that's ultra modern and can only be explained by an architect.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a forerunner project of that for us.
So what do you think of the work that's happened there lately, it seems like they're doing a lot, making it a lot more urban with pushing stuff out in the strip.
Oh, I don't like it at all. I think the strip is a historic road in America.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, right now I just purchased a steel pier in Atlantic City,
mm-hmm.
and the boardwalk is a similar type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
For years there were zoning regulations that required the boardwalk to have active fronts and walk-in type of situations.
Mm-hmm.
The casino boxes, as they got built, they were more interested in exit stairs and code compliance and, you know, having giant scale rather than people scale, even to the point that they have giant walls of louvers on the boardwalk.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true with the Las Vegas Boulevard. The Las Vegas Boulevard is a historical street. It has to be respected with the utmost care, because once it's ruined,
mm-hmm.
it'll be ruined for a long time. And there's a lot of people that get there with architecture
mm-hmm.
who try to, in fact, impose their will on this famous street. And that's not good. I don't like the buildings being pushed out there. If I was a planning department, I would be working on the next master plan for the next 50 years for that street.
Huh. So Monte Carlo with Diablos, same thing?
All those things of creating strips, creating food and beverage outlets that are on there,
mm-hmm.
on the strip, making the strip feel like one a drunken New Year's Eve party,
uh-huh.
that's not what Las Vegas is about
huh.
at all. And those types of things, I've been asked to invest in those things, which
mm-hmm.
I flatly refuse, because I feel that they're an extreme detriment to the architecture, the aesthetic, and the overall reputation of Las Vegas.
So jump on the tracks for a second. How about Project Link?
Project Link is the new project for Harrah's.
Yeah.
We don't know too much about that project
mm-hmm.
yet. We think it's a good idea.
Uh-huh.
The strip, all great streets have what's called Main and Main.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Main and Main.
Yeah.
Now, we've been very fortunate in Las Vegas where we've had four big streets
yeah.
that have defined it. So we have the Strip, Tropicana, Flamingo, Spring Mountain, and Sahara.
Mm-hmm.
Desert Inn is a flyover. So these four streets have defined the Main and Main concept.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has happened over the years is that Main and Main has all of a sudden look like four big projects on the corners.
Yeah.
So Excalibur, Tropicana, MGM, mm-hmm. and Caesar's Palace, or
New York.
New York, New York. So Project Link, to keep something a little bit smaller scale,
mm-hmm.
to extend the strip back into some other areas that need some master planning that could, in fact, add to the tourist experience is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I think it's a real good thing. And I think many of the casinos should start to do that as they push back further and further. Many of them haven't, you know, they've looked at the strip as kind of the strip is here and they're here and walk through my buildings. I think Harrah's has a pretty unique concept. Of course, they want to build some additional buildings and
mm-hmm.
projects and,
mm-hmm.
you know, arenas and things like that back there. So, you know, if you look at it in say, the mall, the arena standpoint. You
mm-hmm.
look at some of the new major arenas, whether it be the, you know, the arenas in Baltimore, the two parks, or you look
mm-hmm.
at the new one in Glendale, Arizona. They all have this kind of link to them.
Hmm.
So I think it's quite a good idea. And if it's filled with great fun stuff,
mm-hmm.
that's reasonably priced, it will be very successful. If it's filled with Gucci, it won't.
Mm-hmm.
If it's filled with magnet stores, it won't. So it's a very delicate blend of entertainment to get things really moving.
Interesting. So moving off the strip, how about the JW Marriott, which opened in 1999?
Mm-hmm.
How is a project like that in Las Vegas, how's that a challenge?
Well, it's a challenge. First off, it was the first casino ever, in my recollection, that actually got a brand name outside of the casino business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was at first a Regent hotel.
Mm-hmm.
It was a challenge to design something within the parameters of a given hotel chain and their expectations and a casino. So that was that particular challenge. And there was another challenge there. It had to fit into the Summerland guidelines. Mm-hmm. So it couldn't be a high-rise building. Mm-hmm. Had it be a low-rise building. Couldn't have a massive amount of parking garages. And it had to be pedestrian-scaled or residential-scaled, mm-hmm. which we all love those challenges. I today still think that 11-acre pool is one of the best pools in all of Las Vegas. Mm. Even beyond, so many of the pools that have been built here. But that pool is really quite spectacular. Matter of fact, that pool today is a part of a national ad campaign for JW Marriott. Hmm. So they think it as well. There's not too many 11-acre pools in their entire chain. But it had this, it was kind of funny. We tried to design it as a hybrid, as a luxury locals casino. The operators tended to shy away from the locals casino and wanted a more higher-end guest, mm-hmm. a more marketed guest, a more golfer-gambler guest, mm-hmm. which then kind of, the $25 buffet kind of puts a bad taste in all the locals' mouth. And that gave the hybrid solution, although it had the necessary elements mm-hmm. to, in fact, work, the pricing and marketing structure of those elements did not work. Huh. And, I still run or own with Gustav Mahler, a very successful restaurant out there. Hmm. And I've owned and run that restaurant for since the beginning. Hmm. So it's 12 years, 13 years old.
Great. So I want to talk about some other projects like Harrah's Rincon. So how do you take this suburban casino idea and scale it to Indian country?
Interesting. Well, you mean the suburban idea?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Harrah's Rincon is a very interesting project for us. We would consider it the first in the group in the years of theming. Mm-hmm. We would consider it the first non-themed project. Mm-hmm. And we did that by doing a series of focus groups in San Diego. We focus grouped five or six designs. Mm-hmm. There was a design that was little like Del Coronado in San Diego. Mm-hmm. There were some California designs, as if Disney was doing the California theme park. It was something of that nature. And we focused one, I think there was one that had a little bit of a Rio look to it, and mm-hmm. I think there was one that had a more of a classical California a craftsman style. But one was fairly modern. Hmm. And the modern one won hands down, 6-1.
Really?
Yeah, but it wasn't modern in the sense of city center.
Yeah.
It was modern in the sense of the Grand Wailea mm-hmm. in Hawaii. So it felt like a resort, had a lot of solid surfaces, and it was a very beautifully organized facility. Hotel tower was built, separate building, beautiful pool. Some of the buildings actually looked onto the pool. And it was also designed to be the most efficient casino in the Harrah's Harrah's group, because of there was a tremendous amount of employee considerations due to Native American country. Mm-hmm. And also, it was really themed and built for many master plan expansions. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, today they are doing expansion number 7 mm-hmm. to that particular building. Good thing was we built 168,000 square foot of podium, 55,000 square feet of gaming, 200 and some odd rooms, mm-hmm. beautiful pool designed by, once again, Lifescapes and Don Brickerup, and we built the entire project for $75 million.
Wow.
Which was, even then, a barn burner.
Yeah.
And I think the whole project, if I recollect, was $109, $110 million all in cost. Hmm. $75 was the construction cost, mm-hmm. and obviously it worked out very good, not only for Harrah's, who still holds the contract there, mm-hmm. but for that tribe, and we're very, very proud of that building.
Interesting. A couple other projects. How about Casino Ray in Helsinki?
Yeah, now it's called the Grand Casino Helsinki.
Okay, how do you take this casino idea and build in Finland?
Yeah, well, that was pretty easy for me, being Scandinavian. Uh-huh. I've been a big fan of the Scandinavian architects all my life. Mm-hmm. Alvar Aalto would probably be one of my favorites. And, of course, some of the architects that the Saarinens, who father and son did the TWA terminal and many great projects in California, are also Scandinavian. Scandinavian design has been a very, very small part of that population you know, as a world population, that design affects a great amount of people. And there's definitely a yearning towards it. Mm-hmm. They are not into classical architecture. They're not into modern architecture. They're into appropriate, scaled, very, very warm things. Yet we had to do a casino that was exciting. Mm-hmm. And Casino Ray was not an exciting casino as it existed. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a, you know, put together by a British type of gaming company, lights flashing, let's try to make Las Vegas in Helsinki.
Yeah.
It was successful. Mm-hmm. And believe me, for that particular company to hire us, I mean, it is a state-owned and run company.
Mm-hmm.
So they are hiring the architect from Las Vegas to do this project in their most famous city. Now, we really wanted to do, because of Nokia, because of the technology in the area, what we would consider the first digital casino.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to do it in very warm tones and have it so that everybody looked and felt very good in it,
mm-hmm.
no matter what the year was, what time of the year was.
Mm-hmm.
So our whole premise of the design was it was always a sunny day in that casino. Because there are many cloudy days,
yeah.
And there's many dark days, and there's many days that the sun doesn't ever come out. And so that was our main premise to, in fact, do that. Of course, the digital stuff that we did was very interesting, the ceiling changing colors, the walls changing colors, and when it was, in fact, done, it was truly trend-setting.
Mm-hmm.
It added about 35% to the win of that between the old and the new casino.
Mm-hmm.
It became a very, very, very successful business and much admired through the entire world, yet the majority of the casino is in a basement. So, I mean, that's almost shocking.
Yeah.
But it is, whenever anybody is talking about how to get a person down to a casino, down to a basement,
mm-hmm.
I always ask them to go visit that casino
to
see how we did it there.
So how do you transition between doing work like that and doing work on the higher end, like for the region, to doing the Harrah's work in their riverboat markets?
Well, every project has a budget.
Mm-hmm.
We are very respectful of the budget. I mean, these are operating businesses.
Mm-hmm.
One of my best friends, Stan Fulton, Stan would always tell me, you know, I made my money 25 cents at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you really look at that, that's technically how casinos make money. So we cannot, many times when, oh, another that column clad only adds $50,000 to it, well, $50,000 is a car, and most people, oh, it's a nice car, most
yeah.
people's
yeah.
vocabulary. So in designing to whatever market you are, whatever mm-hmm. budget you might have, you still use the same fundamental formulas and principles. You still use the same quality in certain of the items that you know you need. Take, for example, the carpet. I mean, you would never do a casino with nylon grade carpets in it.
Mm-hmm.
You would still have the same lighting technology and the light levels, but in less expensive applications.
Mm-hmm.
And the casino would be a little bit plainer. It would be a little bit more like the iPhone, a little bit more imaginary rather than something, you know, that you are trying to force feed people in whatever way they want to be forced, in whatever way the gaming market wants to force feed
mm-hmm.
them. So it's interesting to, you know, when we designed Prairie Nights,
mm-hmm.
cost $13 million in a bluff in North Dakota, you know, it's interesting that you have to work within these parameters. Now, a lot of these parameters, as well as cost, style, finish,
mm-hmm.
are also set by what the local people can actually do.
Yeah.
Because, face it, you're not going to get a great mill worker to go to, you know, to North Dakota. I mean, it's just not, he's not there.
I mean,
they're a Chinese company from Hong Kong is not going to fly over.
Uh-huh.
So but you can actually tailor it. I'll give you an idea. When we did the Windsor High Limit Rooms,
mm-hmm.
Windsor, Canada, I mean, we really tailored, you know, our budgets to spend the most where the most was going to be made
mm-hmm.
and the most was expected.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't actually spend the most where the least was expected.
Yeah.
We only spent it where the most was expected.
Hmm. How about when you're kind of upscaling a whole market. And I'm thinking about the Harrah's Atlantic City work from 2006 or so with that substantial renovation. And if you could just kind of walk us through that and talk about that a little bit.
It's an interesting, once again, the Harrah's pool renovation and expansion was a major project for Harrah's Atlantic City. Major step allowed for by a very thoughtful guy named Carlos Tolosa. The whole thing with Harrah's, a very successful slot business, very, very successful marketing, very successful club points, very consistent offering, lots and lots and lots of absolutely smart and great casino managers. Almost, they like the IBM or the Apple of, of the gaming business. When it came to Harrah's Atlantic City, kind of a designed as a Holiday Inn, opened in 1980. Didn't really pay too much attention to the marina. Built a big parking garage in front of it, so every person that came to it had to pass by this big monster, ugly, terrible parking garage. Got into the spaces and didn't really use the bay and the ocean, although they built a boardwalk at one time and a marina at one time, all of which I think they more or less tore out. But we, once again, took the approach that we wanted to build a suburban experience within it. We were originally commissioned to do a big master plan, which there was some retail shopping and alike that was in there. But we always thought that the retail shopping in Atlantic City was not going to be something that people were going to actually go to. Atlantic City and New Jersey has sales tax issues. There's plenty of shopping 60 miles away, plenty of shopping in shopping malls, and obviously New York, 123 miles away, has Fifth Avenue. So, I mean, although I was proven a little bit wrong because of the success of The Walk, which is an off strip, an off-priced market, has been very, very good. And thank God Atlantic City has that right now. We looked at the pool up there at the top roof of the deck, and I walked up there with Carlos Tolosa. I showed him that. I said, Carlos, I said, I think we could do one really big move here. We can change your market by putting ourselves an indoor pool, having the buffet, having some, maybe a coffee shop, fast food, a new health club, retail corridor, and get this pool kind of the synergy of something that we need that's a bigger than life statement. Because facing a 30-year-old building, you need a bigger than life statement. You can't, a renovation of a restaurant or a renovation of a casino goes unnoticed. It's hard to even say, oh, come to my new restaurant. Oh, isn't that an old restaurant they just fixed up? So you need something over the top. You know, that's and this is really, as you look at renovations and expansions, I always tell everybody, I say, there's very few renovations that have been successful. I mean, there's renovations out of necessity to maintain your market, but there aren't too many renovations that you say, okay, now this place has just been totally reinvented. So I told Carlos we wanted to do that. Carlos gave us about a week. We came back with a very simple plan because we knew Harrah's would only build something very simple. I think it's a 150-foot dome. It's a simple buyout dome. It's not anything exotic like the Mirage is a more exotic dome. And it's simple buyout. The ducts are exposed. And it has this beautiful glass atrium that makes the sun, you know, shine day in and day out. Now, when we were doing it, we thought it was the perfect nightclub venue. We did prep it a little bit. But the current management at that particular time didn't really see the nightclub as a big potential for them. When Jay Snowden, who was a Harrah's executive and, matter of fact, grew up here in Las Vegas, when he came on board, he really took the nightclub to the next level. And, of course, I think that nightclub now is the second or third most successful nightclub on the East Coast of America.
I've heard that.
In 3 or 4 days a week. And I know that my niece loves to go there. I have to give her tickets to go there. But the what that did, it created a suburban spot within the entire Harrah's Casino. It created a significantly new thing in that casino. And it created what we always love is a multi-use space. because the space has use from aesthetics, from reputation, from being a pool, from being a healthful place, to being a nightclub, to being the view for your restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden you're checking all the boxes that all this is starting to work. Mm. And that's what we did there.
So how about building in a market that's still emerging like Macau? You've done a lot of work there. Four Seasons, Grand Venetian, Hard Rock City of Dreams, Oceanus, Galaxy. You know, can you talk a little bit about those projects?
Yeah, for sure I can. I think that building in a brand new market like that is absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people go in with probably a mistake of trying to put Las Vegas wherever they go. I mean, a lot of people are comfortable with Las Vegas. The people that are building it. I think in our first project there, the Sands with mm-hmm. Bill Widener, Brad Stone, and of course the famous Sheldon Adelson. They all wanted something. They didn't want Las Vegas at first. They knew that they were going to build the Venetian at some later date, but the Sands was something that they wanted really to make a difference with mm-hmm. and show that they were very sympathetic with the market,
mm-hmm.
and they were going to study the market, and we did. And, of course, we called that our stadium casino.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard that before, but
mm-hmm.
We thought that gambling, as I went through all the Macau casinos, was less of an activity and more of a sport.
Mm-hmm.
It was that person against the casino. And we all found out that, you know, that the people watching business there is pretty strong, and we wanted to take advantage of that people watching business. And we wanted that casino to feel the exact opposite of most of the casinos there. Not from their physical standpoints of design and personal relationships with people, but we needed not, you know, we talk about the wow in the lobby.
Mm-hmm.
We decided consciously to put the wow in the casino so that everybody would have to see that casino. And I think to mm-hmm. date there's been something like 85 million people go through that casino. Now, all those projects in Macau are all changing the way how casinos are designed throughout the world. The junket business, the high-limit gaming business, that has been changed drastically mm-hmm. by the designs and by what the customer actually wants there. So much so that people are saying, well, doesn't that customer want that here? The slot prevays,
mm-hmm.
I think they're being changed as we sit here today speaking, and our designs are changing drastically. Those slot prevays are, take for example, the high roller slot player doesn't sit at a slot machine. He sits at a chair looking at a slot machine.
Mm-hmm.
So there's many different layouts and many different considerations mm-hmm. and configurations and scale and architecture and design and lighting and all types of things that change for this particular customer. There's also another thing about the tandem-based activities. I think that many of the times our casinos, you know, we try to stretch out the edges, create as lit as possible edges that are as bright as possible, and then put our tandem-based activities. And I think from Macau we learned that we don't need all the tandem-based activities on the casino floors, but we need the ones that promote quick service on the casino floors.
Okay, such as
the faster food restaurants or the noodle bars or the tea stations or
mm-hmm.
those types of things where people are fueling.
Mm-hmm.
They are not actually taking in a distinctive separate experience. And I think the Macau casinos have also created the stadium gaming. We designed the stadium casino,
mm-hmm.
but the stadium slots are really in their infancy and have taken off in Singapore, and now it looks like they're taking off in Macau as well, and that has changed things. So every single thing, from the VIP entrances, the porte-cochères, to how you park, to the noodle bars, to the incredible fast food courts. And if I don't know if you've seen them in Macau, but I mean, some of them. I think the Venetian Macau fast food court has got to be the biggest one in the world. It should be in the Guinness World Book of Records. And I would say on a given day, it probably is doing, you know, some days probably 100,000 meals. It is an incredible spectacular. So all these things in Macau, every single day we learn something.
Mm-hmm.
every single day we're allowed to try new things. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of very, very smart customers over there. Frank McFadden, Ed Tracy, Lawrence Ho, you know, these guys are really, really, and of course Francis Louis, I mean, these guys really are innovative. Mm-hmm. It's almost like Macau in 1989, what the Mirage put here, mm-hmm. and the spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit of design that occurred for the next 10 years in Las Vegas, it's happening right now in Macau on a much bigger scale.
So what lessons did you apply in Galaxy that you learned in your, I guess about was about 7 or 8 years that you'd been in Macau by that point?
Sure. Well, Galaxy, the high limit casinos, we learned a lot about them. Mm-hmm. And designing those high limit rooms, and you know, when you say the high limit rooms, I think there's over 250,000 square feet of them. So
wow.
it's a lot of casino space. We we're about to open the Sky Casino on January 29th
okay.
of 2012. We, as a natural progression of the high limit casinos, mm-hmm. That led us to the designs of the Galaxy rooms. Mm-hmm. Now, we knew that we had a flexible accommodations. Flexible layouts, mm-hmm. big gathering spaces. We technically were designing, I always point that we were designing 9 at that time, now 10, but mm-hmm. 9 Gold Nugget Las Vegas.
Hmm.
We were designing 9 of those. So we had to take into consideration all the required tandem based activities that are fuel.
Mm-hmm.
We had to take into consideration lush, unbelievable private bathrooms,
mm-hmm.
Things that make people feel good. We had to take into consideration the sense of scale and height and of course, the brightness of the spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, in the planning of these things, you know, the high-limit rooms were always like, you know, one entrance, you kind of got dropped off in the lobby and you went into the various high-limit rooms. But no. Now we got to take it another step, so mm-hmm. we got to drop you off at 8 or 9 places or
okay.
6 places or whatever we did, so that the cars, the relationship of the cars in the high limit rooms got very mm-hmm. close together. Then we also had to get the relationship of the hotel elevators. There's always been this thing about planning the casino is in a podium, you walk to your elevators,
mm-hmm.
you've experienced many of the walks here in Las Vegas. The Chinese customer does not like those walks. At all.
Okay.
And will not do them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he's not dropped off close to his casino, close to his hotel elevators, and he doesn't have the hotel room that's next to the elevator,
mm-hmm.
very upset. So consequently, this actually then translates itself into the hotel towers.
Interesting.
Because then you have more hotel elevators.
Mm-hmm.
You have more hotel elevators touching podium spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Where before we were always concerned about the security guard.
Yeah.
The security guard costing $250,000 a year for an extra elevator bank.
Mm-hmm.
Not Macau.
Hmm.
So those types of things, all those things we did in the Galaxy rooms, and that's quite frankly, together with the operations team, of course,
mm-hmm.
is the reason that they have realized so much success.
Interesting. So moving to another casino space, you've done work with Cantor and their sports books.
Yeah, we're going right there.
Yeah, I see. How? Tell me a little bit about that. How did that partnership start, and how do you design a sports book?
That's great. Well, we're very fortunate to be designing with Cantor. Leah Matis is one of the true thinkers of our industry, we mm-hmm. think. He's half Wall Street, half New York you know, guy. And we love him. We mm-hmm. think he's an absolutely great client and very, very knowledgeable client with a very distinctive plan, a very distinctive business plan,
mm-hmm.
and a very distinctive aesthetic plan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he told us his basic goals and, you know, that this particular, this type of betting, this, you know, Apple approach
mm-hmm.
to betting, although it's not done on Apple's, I believe it's done on Samsung's. But that particular approach was really near and dear to his heart. mm-hmm. and was part of the overall practice that he wanted to do. Wanted to focus on some VIP once again. He didn't want our carousels to be lined up, although he knew he had to have a few of them mm-hmm. because of the race bettors.
Yeah.
And he wanted some flexible layouts, some more, let's say, loose party mm-hmm. familiarization types of zones.
Mm-hmm.
And his business model is precise, so he needed science. So aesthetics and science had to be combined to create, you know, his overall wish. Now, we immediately showed him our very first sketch was red.
Okay.
Red was the commerce, was the color of commerce,
mm-hmm.
and we like red. And we showed him a red type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't muted, it wasn't tense, it was bold, it was brash. People looked good in it,
mm-hmm.
and we showed it to him, and he loved it, and we eventually built it. One of the other casinos that has a strong-willed operator in town mm-hmm. decided he did not like the red.
Okay.
So then they went, took one of our plans, and built it in another casino mm-hmm. at a whole different colorway,
okay.
which falls entirely flat.
Okay.
It's nothing like what it is, what it is in the other places.
Okay.
We really think that we'll be developing these things as we go.
Mm-hmm.
with further great examples. We also think that this particular model of betting and gambling is kind of the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like my iPhone sits, you know, this kind of design sits pretty nicely into
yeah.
that particular picture.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that it's just a baby right now. And
mm-hmm.
we actually think that some casinos, not just sports books, will start to look like that, and that seems to be a trend that we are actually exploring in a few spots that don't have sports betting.
Right. So if a casino architecture student wants to come to town and take a look at one sports book, which one would you tell them?
Oh, right now it's the Venetian.
Okay.
Oh, for sure. Has the most sophisticated systems, has the most sophisticated in-game wagering. It is a drastic difference from the Venetian,
mm-hmm.
yet very accepted and liked by Mr. Adelson.
Hmm.
So, which was, we were always a little shaky about that. We
yeah.
knew Lee would love it, we would love it, but we had our, you know, Sheldon, face it, has had great success with the Venetian.
Mm-hmm.
When you do something that is not necessarily the Venetian,
yeah.
But as it turns out, he is absolutely impressed with it as well.
So the big trend on the Strip in the past couple of years has not been new construction, it's been renovations. What do you think about some of the projects like the Stratosphere or Tropicana? What are your thoughts on that?
I think they're difficult.
Okay.
I think they're difficult. We worked on the Stratosphere
mm-hmm.
in the beginning, and we worked somewhat on the Tropicana pool during the renovation.
Hmm.
I think they're, you know, unless you would close the place and you know, close it for a year and really redo it, change, rebrand it, rename it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even look at the Aladdin. I mean, the Aladdin definitely had three major revisions all under the Aladdin name, the Aladdin theme,
mm-hmm.
and each one of them went bankrupt.
Yeah.
Wayne Newton was in the middle there. And even though, way back when, I mean, the Aladdin for a year or so was mm-hmm. the place to go on the Las Vegas Boulevard. But the renovations are very, very difficult, and unless you really do that big thing,
mm-hmm.
that's a problem. Now, we have a very new renovation in Breda,
mm-hmm.
in Breda, Holland, and this is our version of trying to, this is a very new type of casino that we're trying to design right now, and we are taking our logic from our Harris Pool
mm-hmm.
and pushing it over to Breda, Holland, although we don't have the land or,
yeah.
you know, we cannot build a pool, but we are trying to design ourselves called the anti-casino there.
Hmm.
And I'll call it the anti-casino because the casinos, you know, the world kind of suffering from gambling fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the operators are trying to predict in the future And of course, the Tandem-based activities revenues are important.
Yeah.
And so we are working on that type of fun, exciting, glamorous, you know, space that everybody has to be in. And oh, by the way, there is in fact a casino there.
Huh.
So that is somewhat of, and that project will be a renovation.
Okay. On the strip, I caught a blog post you wrote a little while ago about casino smoking. Talk a little bit about that. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I think smoking should be outlawed in every casino.
Okay, now why? It's because the casino guys will tell you never, never, never.
Of course.
Yeah.
They see immediate drop of 15 or 20% in their revenues in the first couple of months. Scares everybody. You know, oh my God, my business is going to end. I think some of the European examples, I just was at a smoking casino in Slovenia, which was outside. Quite nice, quite unique. They have slot machines outside in Slovenia. Very well done, very well designed, very, very popular, not only with the smokers, but with the non-smokers, because they, on a beautiful summer night, they go out there and have a cocktail and a drink, and they're outside. We did the same in Monte Carlo. We did it outside. The casinos in Holland, they have a glass-enclosed room, so it's a fairly large casino, maybe 100, 150 slot machines, and they're only slot machines. And they have a change booth in the center. Now, it's kind of funny in Holland that if they have to go in to pay a jackpot, they have to tell everybody to stop smoking. They have these giant fans. They click them on. They exhaust all the air out of it. They open up the door, and the guy walks in for the jackpot.
Wow.
Okay? And then they push the fresh air back in. When the guy leaves, the door gets shut, and everybody can start smoking again. I think casinos and smoke, I think there's a big thing in America, not necessarily in China. In China, I think it's very difficult to do. But in America, many women tell men exactly what to do.
Okay.
And I think as a group, there are many women who do not like cigarette smoke. They don't like it in their hair. They don't like it in their clothes. They don't like it, you know, they aren't like men where we're laundering things more and this and that. And we don't have long hair. And we, you know, we don't really care what we smell like many times. But women do. And I think that over a period of time, I think that casinos will become more popular if they have cleaner, fresher smelling air. And that's just my opinion. And now, the Silver Slipper tried it.
Yeah.
Of course, went out of business. So we don't want anybody going out of business. Yeah. But I think slowly but surely somebody will try.
So what are some of the benefits of the operator? You talked about some of the cost savings that you'd have.
Tremendous.
So, like, operationally, what are they?
Well, you have to realize, take a building like the Venetian, and you say, okay, I have a podium of, I don't know, my podium of 5 or 6 million square feet, and I have to change that air, and I have to exhaust that air. I'm not allowed to really clean it up, and I have to, you know, do it 10 times an hour.
Wow.
I mean, that is some major energy that's required. Matter of fact, that's why no casino building today could ever hold a LEED certification in any way, shape, or form. There are all types of unusual ways to make very, very fresh, clean air buildings. But when you do a giant refrigerated box that you allow people to smoke in, there is no way. You have to get rid of the air.
Yeah.
And once you would change that, you would go back to more of a normal HVAC system. Less air, less return air, more ducted return systems. You would use a lot less energy, a lot less.
Interesting. So, kind of taking the big picture now, when you're designing a project, when you're working on a project, obviously you're working for the client. Is there anyone else who you're working for, or you trying to design to appeal to other designers, to kind of your ideal patron and other people in the ownership community? Who are you thinking of when you're putting these projects together?
We're thinking the client. I mean, now we do think, maybe young in our career, we didn't think too much of our reputation because we were concerned strictly on our clients. But now we are concerned about our reputation. We don't want to do anything that is you know, that keeps our workforce busy, that in fact would ruin our business. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm still doing this, you know, 33 years later. I think that we've been a progressive enough architect not to just, you know, follow, tag along, do it like this type of solution. We don't really design anything for magazines. We don't design anything for other people to really come in and say, wow. Mm-hmm. We design it for the customers to come in and say, wow. And our best results are, quite frankly, those quarterly calls when, you know, that we hear that the Sands Macau made $80 million last quarter and, you know, continues to make $80 or $100 million a quarter or whatever the building might be. And then we know that we've realized our success, our design is successful. Not because you or I like it, because if everybody is perfectly compatible, me and my wife are perfectly compatible, we've been married for 31 years. If you're perfectly compatible, you only have 50% taste of one another. So there is no person in the world that will walk into any building 100% and say, oh, I love this. This is fantastic. Now, some of the projects that Steve has done here, I mean, who could dislike the Bellagio Garden? I mean, who could dislike that? I mean, you have to be a, you know, a smoker, monger, poker, junkie type of guy who would walk in there, yuck, I hate this. But you know, still, there are lots of people. So we don't design it for any real people but the actual customers and the clients.
Tell me a little bit about Atlantic City and Steel Pier, whatever you can share about that.
Sure, I can share it with you now. Okay. We're going to have a big press conference in a couple of weeks. Steel Pier is going to be a fascinating project. We have been in discussions with CRDA. The CRDA has an ambition to put back Atlantic City to its market. I think the casino owners might have an ambition as well to, in fact, do that. We think Steel Pier will be the cornerstone project to, in fact, do that. Atlantic City has one really great thing, two great things. First of all, it's the biggest, one of the most popular, successful pedestrian esplanades in the entire world. More popular than the Strand, more popular than Ocean Walk and Manhattan Beach, more popular than the Croissant, Croisette in France, more popular than the San Antonio Riverwalk. The Atlantic City Boardwalk is one of the great treasures, just like our Las Vegas Boulevard is, one of the great treasures of that. And the beach, south-facing, beautiful wind, beautiful breeze, and the beach is, once again, one of those beautifully respected things. Many of the casinos got a little confused over the years, tearing out things that enliven the boardwalk, or trying to get away with not having theaters, or working, you know, doing terribly scaled things, or putting louvers out there, or, you know, doing things that, you know, not landscaping the ends of the street blocks. But be that as it may, the CRDA right now has a mandate from the governor. The governor is an amazing guy. I've been with him three or four times. Governor Christie, if there's any politician in the world that can, in fact, do this, can take this city by the bootstraps and say, God damn it, this is what we're going to do. It's this guy. So with all that in mind, we went and bought the Steel Pier. Now, the Steel Pier has an unbelievable history. I mean, a fantastic history. You're from actually around there. So where did you...
Ventnor, Atlantic City.
Ventnor, Atlantic City. Yeah, right. You're from there.
Yeah.
But you're young.
Relatively.
So you when were you actually born?
Born in 73. So my earliest memories of the boardwalk were the electric trams. Remember that that period? And kind of the tail end of T-shirt shops. Dipstick was a big thing. And I was like 10 years old going up there to get dipstick and all that stuff. So yeah, that's my earliest memory there.
Well, the thing is, the pier was popular for us in the 60s when we used to go there as a family. My father, and I'll show you a picture, my father worked there in 1945 when he was 16 years old as he was the motorboat driver for Blackie the Water Skiing Dog. Steel Pier, marvelous history, 1898, was... it's 114 years old today. We bought what I would consider a cherished, prized asset. We bought something that has a reputation. I was in New York last week driving with a driver to get to the airport. I was talking on the phone, something about our Steel Pier financing, and the guy said, Steel Pier. He said, what about Steel Pier? And then he proceeded to tell me six stories of him and his wife, his girlfriends, seeing the porpoise, seeing the cannonball shop, whatever it might be, the oddities of the pier. There are many fascinating things about Steel Pier. And in its day, when Disneyland was built in 55, and the Steel Pier, maybe from 55 to 65, on any given day, the Steel Pier had more people on it than Disneyland. Disney did about 6 million in visitors its first couple years, and Steel Pier does about 3 million of visitors in 10 weeks. So it had incredible days, 85,000 people. Think about that. That's more people than go to Bellagio on New Year's Eve. So it has an incredible history, and we think it's a cornerstone project to, in fact, redevelop Atlantic City. We think that our plans, if accepted by CRDA, which they seem to be at this time, the entire community is excited about it, and we think we can kind of build a hybrid of what it used to be. We can't actually build what it used to be because it's not big enough. People are looking to a $100 admission charge to Disneyland. They get about 100 acres. They get about 40 rides and attractions that are, you know, some of those rides cost $60-70 million. So we have a shorter visit, which is better for the casinos. We have a visit that can be more frequently organized. But we, in fact, can do a lot of the things it used to have. And we are going to put back in the diving horse. And we are going to put back in the Marine Ballroom, which was an unbelievable ballroom. Was it there when you were there? The gold geodesic dome was at the end when you were a kid. But we're going to put back the Marine Ballroom. And we firmly believe that that this particular project, when realized, together with that particular district, which is the key district in all of Atlantic City renovating the city, because the inlet section has never, ever been developed since 1970, when it was called Pauline's Prairie. And we have given some of our ideas to John Jurdy, who is the master planner, who I believe was doing an absolutely incredible job. And we think that, that as a non-gaming amenity, that we can really enhance it, plus make a profitable business there.
Great. So fast forward a couple of years, Revel's going to be online. What else do you think? What do you think Atlantic City is going to look like in, say, 2015?
Ah, well, 2015 is a little close.
Let's say 2020.
Well, I think the inlet section is totally developed.
Okay.
And I think it's not developed with any more casinos. I think the casinos will have to be a little bit. Everybody says, well, the casinos have to be left to the casinos. True, to a certain degree. I mean, you know, the casinos have to be left. But many casinos are 30 years old. I mean, they're old. They're tired. The renovations, I mean, they need Harrah's type of thinking at each of the buildings. And that Harrah's pool thinking, how do we do that thinking at each building? Now, we've just been hired to do a little bit of Tropicana. Tropicana sits very south, well, kind of south. Most people think it's south in Atlantic City, but it's not. But the inlet section will become an absolute jewel. And that will be a big, big attraction to me. We think that Atlantic City will solve with some really unique Tana-based activities. We think there's probably that model that they've started to talk about, the smaller model. That might even get smaller, maybe, and allow for maybe a more youthful exuberance to create a vibrant city atmosphere. We think that some of the transportation issues have to be solved, and we think a real, you know, take a lesson from Macau, Macau-style ferry port there, you know, with kind of daily trips up to Manhattan, New York, and things like this might really solve some of the transportation burden that still sits in Atlantic City. It's never been solved since 1976, although the airport faced it as a drastic improvement of what it used to be. We kind of see that. We kind of see a more artful and thing, and what we call, a little maybe selfishly, the pier effect.
Okay.
There was never a time in all of history, in Atlantic City's history, where the pier effect, where the steel pier, or the pier effect, there was never a time in which there was that much success. And by having that much success on the boardwalk, that many people on the boardwalk that created the buzz and the really, really super successfulness of it. The six piers were kind of interesting. And although this is not the master plan, but this is what we gave the CRDA.
Okay.
As a free thing. Mm-hmm. We're saying, look, we don't have any dogging on being master plan. John's the master plan. John's firm is the master plan. Doing a great job, continue. But this is our vision. This is what we vision around the steel pier, the pier culture. And the pier culture was truly a unique thing. It's not a casino culture. It's not a building culture.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you're out there.
Yeah.
You've stepped across that threshold. You've gone into the ultimate suburban environment, the most natural suburban environment, yet you're doing something. And in the days, you know, the kind of the Atlantic City, I'm actually looking for this clip right here. In the old days, when casino gambling was passed in Atlantic City in 77, right? Couple of years when you were three.
Yeah.
76 it was passed. The first casino opened in 78. The development occurred in 77. When that occurred, the world's most famous architect walked up and down the Atlantic City Boardwalk, John Portman. John did this spectacular building that I would love to own a rendering, a drawing of it, on the corners that would have been a precursor to the Renaissance Center or something like this. But it was in that particular time when he was designing the Embarcadero in San Francisco, Renaissance in Detroit, the Peachtree Center in Atlanta, and he was designing his version of the boardwalk there. Now, Resorts International, with that one sketch, was able to purchase about 50 of those very valuable 70 acres and promised to do it. And part of the legislation back then was, God damn it, you have to do that. But Resorts, through political finagling, was able to buy the Haddon Hall, spend a paltry $30 million on it, fix it up, make it a casino, and allow people to go in there and gamble. 14 years later, they built the Taj Mahal. In that 14 years, Atlantic City went really seriously aesthetically down. Now, it had some rough patches, and then it came back with major CRD investments to create more rooms, which it did, and it came back to a $5 billion market, and now has collapsed again, and continues to collapse every single month. If my logic that was that if John Portman had built that building, that the inlet section would have been entirely different today. It would have been the Embarcadero. It would have been Peachtree Center. It would have been a totally different thing. It was built in a different tax regime. The total tax base of all Atlantic City was $280 million, not $20 billion that it is today. And so consequently, when you have a smaller tax base, people can build and buy and have residential, you know, vacation homes and things like this, but right now it's virtually impossible. We actually, the existing conditions of the inlet looked like that, and then we drew up this master plan, and we said, okay, here is, in fact, what we would consider the pier culture, and here would be the things we would, in fact, do. So we've given that to John, but whatever it is, we believe that it starts with Steel Pier. This development of that whole end of this project starts with Steel Pier. If Steel Pier is successful, then the boardwalk will be successful, then this will become the most valuable piece of real estate in America. And that's what we have proposed to them. But we gave them cost and so forth and so on. Now, the whole gorgeous thing about this whole, you know, for the cruise ship terminal and the different towns and also the cultures. I mean, master planning is about culture as well. I mean, some of the things we said in this, we want to establish the beach club culture. We want to establish the bicycling culture. Bicycling was popular in Atlantic City way before bicycling was popular.
Yeah.
Because everybody rode on the boardwalk. Why doesn't Atlantic City extend it to noon? Why don't they put out some bicycle racks that your bike doesn't get stolen?
Yeah.
I mean, it's simple stuff like that. The lifeguard culture. I mean, why don't we let the girls at Baywatch?
Yeah.
Or the girls in Southern California on a little tiny strip of beach. I mean, we have good-looking guys, 6% body fat, good-looking girls that are beach patrollers. Let's make up the whole thing of them.
Yeah.
The brightest city. Mm-hmm. I mean, our city, the city of Atlantic City, is the darkest city.
Yeah.
The streetlights, the lights, the casinos at the podium levels. I mean, it's dark. It's scary. The jitneys. I love the jitneys. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we should really refer the jitneys. And, of course, we need to have this nighttime lighting effect on the boardwalk that we've actually designed for Tropicana and, in fact, designed for Steel Pier.
So is this what Tropicana is going to look like?
Yeah, that's what Tropicana might look like.
That'll be a big improvement.
It will be. Yeah. It will be. Now, what we're trying to do here on Steel Pier is this. I'll show you just a little tidbit, but, you know, it's not super secretive, although we're not posting it yet.
Okay.
We have started with our advertising campaign, and they're all very, very cute, but that's our advertising campaign.
Fall in love again with Steel Pier in Atlantic City.
Why not? Because people fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And we're starting a Facebook page, which maybe your parents could contribute to, called Steel Pier Stories. Huh. And my father's story will be the very first one on it, as well as several others. Because as I was with a cab driver in New York, and he's telling me those six stories, I said, you know what? There is a whole social networking thing, and there is this thing called Steel Pier Stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the format of Steel Pier Stories.
Mm-hmm.
Which my father is a 16-year-old boy right there, 6% body fat, 33% different than I am, and driving that motorboat for Blackie the water skiing dog, and he told me his little story there, going through the entire pier. Now, the pier, we're going to put a bunch of new rides, attractions, and so forth and so on, and I'll just show you that. There's our new logo. The boardwalk has put into it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it has tremendous historic tradition. Yeah. I have purchased over 100 historical postcards. I have, I'll show you, I have an original 1900 program from the Steel Pier. That's what it looked like.
Yeah.
A great piece of architecture, beat French architecture that was really actually the kind of almost stolen from some of the piers in Britain and England. And, of course, that's what it kind of looks like today. But these are some of the historic postcards. And we have a four-year phase plan because it's a business and it's not a casino. There's no slot machines on it. The Star Flyer we just bought in Austria. Diving Horse we're going to put back. We're going to do a whole refurbishment of it. And then we're going to put this ride at the end, and then it starts to look like this.
So how would you describe the style? It looks like the building at the base that you've got, the dome.
Seaside Victorian.
Okay.
It's a seaside Victorian style, and it is of the original style.
Hmm.
I mean, that's what we are trying to do. We do not feel anything. I can show you what Trump wanted to do.
Okay. Love to see that.
But we, by the way, think this song, which is very appropriate for the Steel Pier, but we think this song was played on the Steel Pier in 1942.
Huh.
And it's Tommy Dorsey and the Pied Pipers, of which Frank Sinatra was a singer.
Huh.
So that's the entire look of the four-phased project.
It's incredible.
Phase one, phase two, phase three.
So what's in these colonnades? Or is that just windows?
The colonnades are a couple things we want to do. We're going to promote a picnic lunch up there, as it used to be in the old days. So we want to actually build these little mezzanines that people can walk up on and actually have their own picnic lunch without having to buy any food from us.
Yeah.
There's the horse stadium.
Okay.
That's the rocket. There's the Star Flyer. Here's the yo-yo.
Huh.
They're all rides. That'll be ticketed rides.
Okay.
But the Star Flyer is gorgeous. It's a gorgeous, unbelievable. It'll be, that ride will be the most popular ride in America.
Huh.
I guarantee you, once you take that. The building, of course, looks great with billboards.
Yeah.
And corporate sponsorship is a big part of it. We have had our first meeting yesterday with Coca-Cola on it, and Coca-Cola loves it.
Great.
Absolutely love the project. Great nighttime lighting effect. Not tacky. Uh-huh. Very building. Very organized.
Mm-hmm.
Very historical. So it can feel and look like something out there, as you can see during the night. Here's a project. We bought it 7 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So we're already with CRDA.
Wow.
We're already getting our EDA grants. We're already permitting it. Already getting our much admiration from the politicians.
Yeah, I can see why.
They're saying this is exactly what Atlantic City needs, and this is what we're going to give them.
So how long does it take you to go from concept, we want to buy this, to a presentation like that?
It didn't take me too long. It all depends. I mean, lots of things you have to take. I think lots of places I have to study. I have a built-in advantage. I grew up going to this place, so I firmly understood it. I was in all these spaces. Mm-hmm. So, it's a good conceptual study estimate is, 3 to 6 months.
Huh.
That's what it is. But that's, you can see that's probably, we probably owned it for 7 or 8 weeks, I guess. Oh, we got it September, so September, October, November, we've owned it 12 weeks. So that's, but that was also done, I think, 4 or 5 weeks ago. So,
got one final question for you for the interview, which is kind of a big question. Where do you think casino architecture is heading?
Well, I think there's one big trend that I think we're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
I think that casinos will be designed and more tailored for their customers and ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
I think casinos will be smaller. They will be more tailored to a very specific demographic. Designing things for just one demographic and, having the Steve Wynn speech that anybody upwardly mobile, anybody who wants a sense of what their life could be coming to my property is probably not the one-size-fit-all type of solution that we're going to have in the future. We think that we will see, if a casino has that ultimate right to, in fact, build a large facility, whether that be in Las Vegas or in a new jurisdiction, such as Singapore or Japan, we think that that facility will have a lot of tailoring within it for different ethnic groups and different age groups, and will be more organized for an attraction like that. We also think strongly that many people look at the MGM and the theme park that we were actually construction drawing architects for at the MGM as being a bellwether against the integration of family entertainment into this. We think this is one of the casinos' big mistakes that they've made over the period of time, that they haven't really thought of or done family-based entertainment. I love Steve Wynn to do it, or Sheldon to do it, because they would really do it well. I mean, face it, a theme park by Steve Wynn would be incredible. So, I mean, we really think that, and quite frankly, we have several projects now that do feature small amusement parks, that do feature small water parks, those types of things that are paid admissions that, that casino developers could actually get someone else to do. And we do feel that casinos, a little bit like the resort at Summerlin, its relationship to golf, but that relationship to golf, residential, real estate, those types of things will be stronger in the future as well. There are a lot of minor points, you know, that I would say lighter, brighter, cleaner, solids, not office building look, nothing like work. I mean, you know, curb pass, red, the color of commerce, those types of things. I would have a lot of those types of things to say about the future, but that's the big points that I have. And I kind of think Steel Pier, you know, to be honest with you, kind of fits in one of those niches that we're going to see. And we're going to see, you know what the beauty about Steel Pier is? Let's see if it works almost in 100 days. In 100 days, we start to see if it starts to work. It's not something that we have to, you know, oh my God, we got to spend $6 billion and will it work? But Atlantic City is a built-in market, so 29 million, 28 million people there. So that's we'll start to see it working or not working in 100 days.
Great. Well, that's great. Thanks so much for doing this interview.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
Very, very good.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of the Center, UNLV, its faculty, staff, or benefactors. For more information, please see us on the web at gaming.unlv.edu.